Tonight on Arena, director Aisling Clark on Frey Waka, an Irish horror film, and Kit Duvall on her novel The Best of Everything. You can text us on 51551 or tweet at RTE Arena or watch live on rte.ie/arena. Themes of ritual, superstition and paranoia permeates the new Irish language horror film Frey Waka. The story centres on Shu, a care worker who relocates to remote parts to look after Peg, an isolated, agoraphobic woman who fears the fairies as much as her neighbours. An interdependent bond developed between the two women, which has consequences for Shu, as the tragedies from her own past come to haunt her. I'm delighted to be joined in studio by the writer and director of Frey Waka, Aisling Clark, and one of the stars of the film, Claire Munnelly, who plays Shu. You're both very welcome.
Thanks,
you had a fair shoe in the door there when, I don't know, Conaharla Petty. But you're so welcome. Aisling, can you tell us first about the title, Frey Waka?
Yeah, so Frey Waka, anyone who speaks Irish listening will know that that literally translates as roots. But I think the word in English doesn't have the same heft as the word in Irish, you know. So to me, it conjures up thick, heavy, tangled roots that are buried deep in the soil and you have to get your spade out and you can't plant anything. And that's kind of what it's evoking for me.
And now it's spelled F-R-E-W-A-K-A. So that's a...
Just so people can pronounce it. That was the compromise that we made.
Well, thank you very much for that. Now, you grew up with these stories. So maybe you'll just bring us into Shu's story first and then we'll see the strange forces that are in the film.
Yeah, so Shu is a very modern, progressive, contemporary Dubliner. She lives in the city. She kind of represents modern Ireland. And then she's sent over to, I specifically don't say where it is, but she's sent over somewhere much more rural, that she's expecting the woman she's going to be taking care of to be very traditional, stuck in her ways, and that she's just going to have to suffer through it. But when she gets there, she kind of figures out that they have a lot more in common than she thought.
So, Claire, you play Shu. And so we see her leaving one home, her home in Dublin, and then she goes to this place which doesn't have a name, but it's very rural, very isolated, and she has to care for Peg. But what can you tell us about the trouble she's left at home, in the home she's left?
Yeah, I think, Shu gets called away from her pregnant fiancé, Mila, who... They've both been clearing out her mother's apartment. Her mother has recently taken her own life and she's had to come in and clear out this apartment full of memories and remnants of her mother. And I think to some degree she was happy enough to be called away or summoned away. She makes the argument to me that they need the money, that the, you know, she needs the work and they aren't in a position to turn it down. But I think to some degree she is maybe running away from the responsibility of becoming a parent, but also the memories of her mother that are left behind. So even though she pretends she's taken one for the team, I think she's happy enough to be summoned to some degree.
Yes, and she goes to this isolated place by bus and arrives at night and she makes contact with Peg through, she tries to make contact with her, but she has a foray around the house to try and locate Peg. And Peg is played by Brittany Nocton.
Hello?
Shit.
Avanna Kilavrija?
Fuck. You'll miss a hanolig in the stack, and I'll say, I'm good to you, okay, Wayne.
Her primary care on Shaw May. Feic. Shamai D. Bulti Carclore.
Shin Moon.
Ugh.
Can't hate that he just shin that.
Hey. Hey.
Now, that's Claire Munnelly there, who is across from me as Shu, and Brittany Nocton is playing Peg, and I'm here with Aisling Clark, the director, as well. So Were you, is it fair to say that you were brought up in folklore and stories about fairies and straw boys? Because all these, they're quite dark forces in this, make an appearance in Fruaca.
Yeah, I was raised with these stories about Naoise, and I went to Gaelscoil, so I was getting it at home because my father was very interested in all this folklore and mythology, and then I was also getting it at school. And I was always a big horror fan, but I have to say the stories that I heard about Naoise scared me more than stuff like Nightmare on Elm Street or whatever else I was watching.
All right, so what kind of stories of the Naoise did you hear?
Well, I mean, there was all kinds of everything, but the overwhelming thing was that they wanted us to suffer, that the Naoise are very aggrieved with us and they want us to go through punishment for something. And it was essentially extended torture that they would put people through. You know, you'd wrong them in some way. They've got all the rules that are quite arbitrary and a bit sort of bureaucratic. And if you get something wrong, you put a foot wrong, they're going to punish you by like filling your bed full of thorns every night for the rest of your life, by making it so you can never be warm, by putting you through some kind of physical trauma or pain.
So when Shu meets Peg, what do they make of each other, Claire?
I'm just thinking back to the first time that myself and Breed saw the film was in Locarno at a festival, and that moment that you played there, there's a jump scare, and I was sitting beside Breed and I jumped. She kind of looked at me because obviously it was me. But so their first meeting is quite combative, and it's how their relationship kicks off. Is the character of Peg doesn't want to be looked after. She doesn't want to let somebody into her home because she is frightened of who Shu might be or who Shu might represent. She wants Shu to prove to her that she is indeed human and not one of these people who have been, or not one of these beings who have caused her such trauma and such harm over the years. So yeah, they start out quite cold, but they come to develop quite a close and a bonded relationship when they realise just how much more similar they are than they thought originally.
Yes, because Breed's character, Peg, has no truck with Shu really at the beginning.
Oh, no.
She wants to get rid of her and does everything to do that.
She wants a cigarette and she wants to be left alone. But that's not what Shu has been paid to do, so.
Now, in this clip, we get an inkling of maybe what might be in Peg's past. Brittany Nocton again plays Peg. And Shu has met a friendly local woman called Maeve, who's played by Dorothy Duffy. And she fills her in on what she knows about Peg.
Is Cass special to Ian Van Hoos?
No more on Anna, either he.
Jerther Groshi Ashta Agoni. Agoraphobia is Castle. Bishigyund in the Tihan Magdalene Blaintohan. Shinan Rudd the Jerther.
Mavlana Vekion.
Bishishinner Fad Riv Maamsa. Is she Melchin and Doyer Haishid Ladini? And Troshin.
Gramad Mave.
Dorothy Duffy there as Maeve, filling in Shu as much as she can on Peg's life. So we hear their mention of the Magdalene laundries. There's the rumour is that Peg had been in a Magdalene laundry and not sure if she had if she gave up a baby or what the story is. So is that the heavy presence that's all over this film, or are there even deeper, more historic heaviness?
It's, well, I mean, the antagonist in the film is the Naoise, but there is this, they're kind of like a metaphor, I see it, for all of the various traumas that the Irish have experienced as a nation over many, many centuries. So there's a point when Peg, Shu asks Peg, what's it like down there, like in the other world? And Peg says, she lists off, it's like a deserted famine village, it's like a coffin ship, it's like a street full of blood and bullets. You know, she goes through everything, and Magdalene laundries included. So it's, they're kind of, that's what I'm exploring, is the huge weight of all of these traumas that we're still kind of carrying on our backs, I think.
Yes, and I think you include the Irish language in that, or the loss of the Irish language in that.
Yeah, I think that's a very particular kind of pain that takes away the ability to communicate about the landscape. Language is so linked to landscape, even what my point about the word Fraoica and what it kind of conjures versus the English translation. So I think that is something that colonised people share, is that feeling of a loss of language that's kind of inarticulable.
Now, Claire, the trauma that your character has, and then obviously she comes in contact with Peg, who also is suffering trauma, much of it outlined there by Aisling. And then there's a kind of a, what would you say, a merging of the griefs, merging of the personalities, merging of the spirits.
Yeah, well, I think when she arrives, she feels herself to be quite separate from Peg and quite different, and there is that that country city divide, and I think she thinks she's quite progressive and this is just a job she needs to do. But as the things move forward and her mind starts to shift a little bit, she starts to experience the world in a way that is more like the way Peg experiences it, and she's trying to figure out if it's, is she losing her mind or is she seeing things more clearly, I suppose. And they come together in a way that is very unexpected to, I suppose, to try and fend off these malignant beings. So yeah, they connect in a way that is unexpected, I think.
Now, as you said, your character has a pregnant partner at home, Mila, who is played by Alexandra Bystrykskaya.
That's as good as I did.
A wonderful actress. Is she Ukrainian?
She is. She's Ukrainian.
Yes. And Shu's partner is Ukrainian. And they're having a phone call. And this is the first of the phone calls where I think Mila's character really wants Shu to come back to the house and sort out her mother's stuff, because she feels there's a lot there that you're not dealing with.
See, I did.
Jeez, Margaret.
Conosce tatu?
Well, she jackarock. Not me in the roddy shy gowny.
No, so, jak tam twoja ukraińska mowa? How's it?
Grand. Everything's there?
Good. I mean, what should I do with anything personal? Like letters, photos, you know?
Just throw them out.
I can't do that.
Yeah, you can.
Sure, you have to at least look.
Look, I can't leave her alone for long.
Sure.
I'll talk to you tomorrow. Okay?
So there, you had said that that Shu's mother had taken her own life. So she's obviously traumatised and really can't deal with it. And even though she's ignoring her girlfriend's request for her to come back, she knows really that, well, I suppose things catch up with you.
Yeah, I think Shu thinks she's just getting on with things, whereas Mila is probably the more emotionally mature of the two of them and knows that if she doesn't deal with these things head on, that they're going to come back and bite them in the future, whether it's the two of them or their relationship or indeed the relationship with their child. So she's really keen for Shu to come back and face this thing, even if it is just clearing out her mother's apartment to make some sort of peace with how her life ended. But Shu is just, I think, determined to not deal with that, and she had a very difficult relationship with her mother and isn't really ready to face it yet, I don't think.
All right. And what was it like playing opposite Breach in these? Did she do a lot of talking about what were your relationship, you and Breachley Nocton, who plays Peg? Because you're in most of the film together.
Yeah, I mean, it was incredible to work opposite Breach. I've watched Breach on stage and screen for as long as I can remember. Not that she's old at all. but she's such an incredibly accomplished and wonderful actor and such a generous team player. And pretty spooky
in this.
And so utterly contrary to how she is in real life. Peg was a real departure for her, but it was so lovely to get her to see her embody that. And she's just a joy to play with and to play opposite. And yeah, she gave it the absolute lash. There's some scenes where she really has to go all out, not to give any spoilers. And she just really threw herself into it. It was a real joy to play with her.
Not behind the door and going all out yourself, Claire, in some of the scene.
Yeah.
Aisling, tell us about the look of the film. Can you just describe, let's say, first of all, the landscape and then the characters that might appear and scare the life out of you in the landscape?
Well, I wanted it to look kind of a bit magical, you know. It's very daylight, you know, for a horror film. There's shoes run around the street at one point, but it's broad, broad daylight. It was the height of summer when we were shooting. There's a lot of like lush greens and that real sense of Ireland in a beautiful way, you know, even though it's a horror film. And we have straw boys, which some of the listeners will know from the old straw weddings. So it's very rare that you'd encounter one of those nowadays with the big straw masks. And we have biddy boys making an appearance as well.
So what's a biddy boy?
Biddy boys were people who, well, they would be your neighbours, and they would put on these masks and different clothing. They might dress as if they're, if a man might dress as a woman, vice versa, to disguise themselves, so you don't know who they are. And very similar to the straw boy kind of tradition as well. And they would come around and you'd have to give them food or a drink or whatever, or else you'd get in trouble, you'd be tricked in some way. So yeah, harken back to some of those old traditions. And
there's a wake house.
That's right. There's a wake house. Yes.
You don't have to tell us in the plot, but is that it's a house where there's a wake going
on?
Yes,
there's a wake going on. We have the sign in the road that some of you'll know as well, saying wake house, that the Undertaker puts up, and all those various kind of trappings that come with that traditional Irish wake.
All right. So let's go into Peg's house then. How did you image up what you wanted to be in Peg's house?
I wanted it to feel like an other place. I didn't want it to feel familiar in any way. So the house is sort of magical as well, in a weird kind of a way. It's on the border in Ravensdale Forest, County Louth, and it hasn't been in any other films, whereas that's quite rare in Ireland. Usually you see the same houses pop up a lot, but this one has never been shot in before. And it's a weird, beautiful, strange place. The family, older man and his son, man's in his 90s, son's in his 50s, lived there the whole time we were shooting. But it had the air that I wanted of just decades and decades and centuries of stuff, you know, like heaving with things. And it's very hard to do that just from set design. We did bring in our own set design too, but the house itself has so much character.
Yes, and as in every horrible, horrible horror movie, there's worse than just the house, there's a cellar in the house.
And there is indeed, yes, and there was a cellar in the house as well. We had to build the doorway that we use, that we cheat as the doorway into the cellar, just because of space constraints for shooting. But yeah, we have a very spooky scene down there.
Yes, very spooky scene. You were asked to write this film.
Yeah.
And so this is our wonderful colleagues in T.G. Cahir.
I had written a film called Dinan that Damien McCann directed a few years back. And then one of the producers, Dermot Lavery from Double Band in Belfast, said, "Aisling, would you do an Irish language horror film for the T.G. Cahir Cine Cahir scheme?" And I thought, well, maybe I would. And I need to think about that. And this is what eventually came out of it.
Right. So in Dinan was a more caper.
It was like a crime sort of thriller type thing starring Breege Brennan, who originally was actually going to be in Frank as well. He introduced me to
Breege, and Peter Coonan was on Arena talking about it as well. Yes, yeah.
Another marvelous actor, and that's where Claire came from too, because Claire was in Dinan, actually. So,
all right. So you came back for more with Aisling.
Gladly.
Yeah. So what is it? This goes on release now in Irish cinemas.
That's right. Aisling. On Friday, it'll be in Irish cinemas, and wonderful to get it out there.
Yes. And you, as Claire said, you've been in Locarno already. So are you hoping to get on the festival?
I'm coming to the end of that now. You're because right, the okay. release is happening. But I've been everywhere, and I'm going to be in
Estonia. And what was that like? What was the experience of that like?
Wonderful. I mean, I've been in the States. I've been all over Europe. And the reception has been, for something that's an Irish language film and that is in its roots, pardon the pun, such an Irish film, to know that it can be universal too. It's been received so warmly everywhere I go. It's been marvellous.
Now, is the Colin Keown and the success of The Quiet Girl, is that opening doors for it? Or is it... the whole horror genre in Ireland has now taken off with such fantastic films.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure that on Colleen Kuhn has had some effect, but horror is such a... The horror audience are very loyal and they're always looking for more stuff, and they love a unique perspective, which this is. They love some, and they're not afraid of subtitles, something in another language. So I think the horror audience has been just kind of lapping this stuff up and looking for it. And there's a big horror moment happening from Ireland at the minute. There's on an international scale, there's just kind of an Irish horror moment that I'm glad to be part of.
Would you do more horror, Claire?
Yeah, happily. Happily. It's good crack. We had a lot of fun. Despite,
yeah, we did. It is really good fun. Yeah.
Despite how harrowing parts of the film are, we had a really, really good
behind
time.
The scenes, we're having a laugh. Yeah,
yeah, really. And like that's so important as well when you're playing a character who's going through something difficult that you can have the crack on set, and we really did. We had a ball.
Well, director Aislinn Clark and actress and lead actress in it, Claire Munley, thank you so much. Free Walker goes on general release in cinemas this Friday, and we'll be reviewing it on Thursday on Arena. Kit Duvall, the award-winning author who made her name with her first book, My Name is Leon, has written a novel about kindness. The Best of Everything is set in her native Birmingham in the 1970s and follows the story of Paulette, who, after the sudden death of her lover, must navigate grief, then motherhood, and the unexpected arrival of a boy in need. Other fiction by Kit includes the memoir Without Warning and Only Sometimes, a short story collection. She also edited Common People, an anthology of working class writers. And I'm delighted to be joined by Kit Duvall, who's joining us, I think, from Birmingham. Is that right, Kit?
Just outside Birmingham, yes, but you'll get the accent. You'll get the full flow of the accent.
How wonderful. So, Kit, tell us about Paulette. She's your central character, and we meet her when she's deeply in love.
Yes, and she's the sort of person that thinks no one notices her. She's very ordinary. She'd be the sort of person that would always be in the kitchen in parties, making sure everyone else has got what they need, never thinking about herself. She's in love. She's desperate to get married and have a house and have a baby, you know, just the normal things in life. She's not super ambitious. She just wants a regular life, a family. She wants a house full of kids with the washing on the line, that kind of thing.
Yes, and she was born in St. Kitts, and she's an auxiliary nurse now in Birmingham, and she lives next door to her Irish neighbour, Maggie. And tell us about this man, Denton. I mean, he seems fabulously attractive and a real catch when we meet him first.
Yes, I mean, handsome, got his own car. She says he's got 32 perfect teeth. He's got all the patter, and he pursues her, and he knows that she's that kind of a girl who won't make demands, who is going to always be there cooking a meal, doing as she's told, and he takes advantage of her. I mean, he's the typical bad boy.
Right. Can you tell us then what happens to Denton, which opens up this whole terrible story of what a bad boy he is?
Yes. So he has a car accident. He's involved in a car accident and he dies. When he dies, Paulette actually finds out that he was married with children, and she feels not only heartbroken, but foolish and disgraced, because she's a Christian. She brought up a Christian, brought up to think of, you know, being honourable. And so that really sends her into a downward spiral. And she finds really that is the turning point in her life. She never really recovers, not just from the loss of Denton, but the loss of her dreams.
Yes, and the interesting thing about the book is that she continues to believe and feel that Denton was the love of her life.
Yes.
Even though her friends tell her, oh, he really got you there, he had you for a fool. And she's, you know, pushed up against the wall by her friends, told what a fool she is. And she knows she was fooled by him, but she really did fall for him.
She did. She fell heavily, and it was the magic, really. It was this beautifully handsome man telling her she was special. And more than the love of him, it was the fact that this was the point. She's 29. She's seen all her friends get married and have children, and this is her chance. So really what he did in dying was ruined her dreams. And that's all she ever really, really wanted. And I think everything else was never going to match up to the beautiful future she saw for herself, with a crib, with a matching quilt cover. And this is what she was going to do with the baby. And this was the dress she'd wear for the wedding. And it was that destruction, really, that crippled her.
And then an unlikely candidate, Denton's friend Garfield, kind of steps into this void, and and she does have a baby, and she does have this beautiful child, Bird, which, you know, fulfills like this kind of need in her to be a mother.
Yes, absolutely. She thinks, and the love that she would have given to Denton, she pours into this child. He is everything to her, the best of everything. The title of the book is really based on her desire to give this child all of her love, smother him with it, because he's the consolation prize.
Now, knowing it's a Kit Duvall novel, it's not going to be that simple. The idea of being a mother is not going to be just a biological mother loving her child. So you add complication to this by adding another young child to the mix. What can you tell us, without spoiling the novel too much, about where Cornelius comes from?
Cornelius is a boy who's not looked after properly, and he needs everything. He needs shoes, he needs clothes, he needs love, he needs his haircut, he needs everything. And when Paulette comes across this child, even though she really, really wants to walk away, and she says, I should walk away, and I've got enough to do without looking after this child, there's something about him that tugs at her heartstrings, and she mothers him. I mean, there's no other way around it. She doesn't want to. She loves him, but she thinks, look, I've got my child, and I've got plans for my child, and my child's going to go to university. All the same, Cornelius is there in her house, eating her food, and he finds a place in her heart.
Now, these characters didn't come from nowhere. They were small ancillary characters in your novel, My Name is Leon.
They were auxiliary characters in another novel. Not My Name is Leon, actually, but another novel that I was writing.
Oh, and then did you know all along that you were going to, well, that there was something in them that had you know, purpose that you would like to explore further?
No, I didn't. They really were B characters, and I thought they'd stay B characters. It's only when I got to the end of that novel and it wasn't right, I knew it wasn't right, and I realised I'd been writing the wrong story all along. So then I just had to start from scratch and write the story that it already, you know, it should have been at the beginning.
Oh, right. And how difficult is that? How much did you have to put away?
I probably kept 20,000 words, and I had to write another 50,000.
And was that heartbreaking?
Yes. Yes,
it was. I can imagine.
But you know, when you've got the fire, when you've got the bit between your teeth, I mean, yes, it was hard. And I've still got the other bit of the book that I didn't, you know, I didn't use. So, yes, it was difficult, but it felt all along right. It's almost like I had to get to the end of the other book to realise that this was the story I needed to tell.
Now, the character of Cornelius or Nelly, he is not the biological child of Paulette, and he's a white child, whereas her son Bird is her own colour, a black child. The whole idea of mothering as opposed to being a biological mother is something that you were very interested in exploring.
Yes, always have been. My mother was a foster carer. She was also a childminder, and sometimes those children just didn't go home for a couple of days because we had that kind of house. There's five of us. I have got a half-brother, much older than me, that we only found out about when I was about 12. And I also have two adopted children. I know all about the possibilities for love of people that you are not related to and how that can bring trials, of course, but joy and just the same depth and richness of relationship and connection that you can have with somebody that you're related to.
Yes, because I said it's a book about kindness, but it's also a book about policies, like the state that Nelly or Cornelius is in, because he's been looked after by a shell of a man, his grandfather, who you call Shirt and Tie, who's never going to be able to mind this child. And she just takes it upon herself to step in and be a mother.
Yes, absolutely. She sees the need and she's got every reason to walk away, and she just can't. Her conscience won't let her, her goodness won't let her, her kindness won't let her, and she acts on the best impulses of humanity, which is the kindness of strangers, showing kindness to people that you don't owe anything to.
Yeah, and those decisions to mother somebody can be tough, because the child has been neglected in this case and therefore has many challenges, and therefore gives more challenges to Paulette, who's trying to make up for the void in his life.
Absolutely. And Paulette has no money. You know, she works a very menial job. She's got responsibilities of her own. She wants love as well. She wants attention. And yet this boy, she sees the need and she meets the need. She doesn't sort of think, none of my business, which she'd be so entitled to do. She just reacts humanely, and he gets under her skin. I mean, that's the bottom line. He comes to love her and she comes to love him.
Now, you, as so often you do, you do deal with racism in the book. As I said, Nelly or Cornelius is a white boy, a Bird is a black boy. And you explain, you also, Garfield, who's a boyfriend of, later boyfriend of Paulette's, there's scenes in the book where the difference between how, let's say, the police force deals with black people and white people is writ large.
Yes, definitely. And it's illustrated when the two boys get arrested and how differently they're treated. And it's also illustrated when Paulette comes across a police officer in circumstances where she's nearly attacked somebody. And she knows that if she doesn't rein it in, there's every chance she gets arrested and separated from a child. The racism is always also illustrated with Maggie next door from Wexford, who's had to leave her country, had to leave Ireland to come to Birmingham to live. And yet she doesn't fit in. She knows she doesn't fit in. She wants to go back home. But economic circumstances being what they were, Maggie thinks, well, I've got to stay here.
Yes, because Paulette feels she has to check herself, or if she doesn't check herself, somebody else, Garfield in this case, her boyfriend, a black man, will tell her to check herself or she'll get into big trouble.
Yes, absolutely. And it's that immigrant experience where you know that you've got to fit in, you've got to work twice as hard, you've got to not say the word like that, but you've got to say the word like that. It's very much a loss of culture and identity when you're an immigrant in another country. You cannot be yourself. You're always double checking to make sure that you're understood or you're doing the right thing.
Now, there's a lot of men of different personalities in the book, and you have a great line where you said that men treat women like their rafts. Could you explain that metaphor for us?
Yes, it's actually Maggie who's trying to explain to Paulette how bad men are. And she said, look, men treat women like rafts. You only let go of one raft or one piece of wood in the ocean when you've got your hands on another. And that's Paulette's experience, that no man just lets go of the raft or the piece of wood when they're in the ocean until they make sure they've got somewhere else to go.
And that is true of some of the characters, yes, in this. In fact, old Denton had a lot of rafts, I think, on the go.
Yes, that's right.
So, as you say, kindness, redemption, recovery. I mean, Paulette, it gets, you know, we've portrayed her here as this wonderful, resilient woman, but she gets it all coming against her, and she is battered and bruised and really down on her luck towards the end of the book.
Yes, she is. I mean, and kindness is its own reward, but sometimes that kindness can just deplete you. And that's what Paulette finds, that actually keeping up that level of giving and giving and giving and feeling as she does that she doesn't get it back is exhausting for her. And when she makes a mistake later on in the book, she just thinks, well, why am I bothering? Why am I trying to be this person, this good person, when everything's going wrong for me? And it's really the low point for her.
And it kind of does turn around for her, but that's not always true, is it? You know, given that you've written this book and chosen to put a hopeful view in it. But that's not always the way for people who give and who pick people out to nurture.
No, it's definitely not always the case. And I think what's really interesting is that if you are one of those giving people, you do have to make sure that you also give to yourself and you also look after yourself and you show kindness to yourself. And that's perhaps Paulette's problem, in that she puts herself so at the bottom of the heap where it comes to giving out kindness. And if the other moral would be to also look after yourself, to show that love and concern and consideration, each one of us for ourselves.
Now, you mentioned there, My Name is Leon, that novel that brought you so much fame. You have gone back into that story, is that right? Or that's what you're currently working on? You might not want to talk about it too much.
Yes, I can't talk about it too much, but I'm writing the sequel to My Name is Leon. He's an adult.
That's all you can say?
Yes, he's right. 37. I'll say he's 37.
Okay, and are you there or nearly there?
I am exactly halfway through at the moment.
All right, very good. So, Kit, you're a great advocate for inclusivity in literature. We talked to you, I think the last time we talked to you was about Common People, the working class writers anthology that you edited. And you also are, you know, very much a champion of the older writer, because you began to write older in compared to many writers.
Yes, I was 56 when My Name is Leon was published, and I started to write maybe in my mid-40s. And so much of the publishing industry, and not just publishing actually, so much of the world is concerned with youth and the new shiny thing and, you know, having your finger on the pulse and this, you know, the new young writer and what are they bringing, overlooking the fact that there are so many writers that come to writing late, sometimes because of economic circumstances, sometimes because of child rearing, sometimes because, like me, I had nothing to say when I was young and I wouldn't have been a good writer. And the value and the wealth of knowledge and sometimes the wisdom of people that are older really needs to be celebrated. And publishing shouldn't be about just celebrating the young. There's nothing wrong with that. But also making space for those people that are coming to writing, you know, maybe 50, 60, 70, 80, but they have something to say and they have such a different take on the world, a take that has come about through many, many years of living and experience and insights. And I'm very, very keen on more first-time writers that are writing in their 60s or 50s onwards, coming to publishing and having the same attention given to them that we have to younger writers.
Well, Kit Duvall, it's been a joy as ever to talk to you. And the best of everything is published by Tender Press. Kit Duvall will be here at the International Literature Festival Dublin on Saturday, the 24th of May. Further details from ilfdublin.com. Kit, thank you so much.
Thank you.
There's a new Irish national dance company. It's called Lúil, which means movement. And its first show, which opens the Dublin Dance Festival in May at the Borgosh Energy Theatre before going on a nationwide tour, is currently in rehearsals. Liz Roach is the artistic director of Lúil, and she and three other choreographers have created the company's first major show, Chora. It draws on the ancient Greek concept of chora, a space that is both physical and abstract. This triple bill presents a dynamic exchange between dancers and musicians, drawing on themes of memory and landscape. The three works, I Contain Multitudes, by choreographers Guy Nader and Maria Campos, Constellations by Liz Roach, and Invocation by Mufetor Yusuf. I joined the rehearsals in Dance House, where the dancers were working on the third piece, Invocation. I asked one of the Lúil company, dancer Clara Kerr, to bring us inside the three pieces, I Contain Multitudes, Constellations and Invocation.
Well, I Contain Multitudes, it's a real physical piece. It's really beautiful, and it's a lot of sort of synchronised, we call them constellations as dancers, so there's quite a lot of circular formations that we break out of and sort of integrate into the space together. There's a lot of partner work. Gay and Maria are incredible and work a lot in contact improvisation and with contact with each other. So it was a whole skill that we were learning as a group together. So there's some fun like lifts and throwing and all sorts of taking weight in different ways. So it's going to be a real sort of feast for the eyes, I hope.
And then the next one then is called Constellations, and that's Liz Roach's
yes.
baby.
Yes, Liz's is really interesting. It feels like there's a lot of space, almost like a meditation on sort of space and time and connection with each other. So there's some really beautiful imagery and hugging, and it's almost like we have this secret communication together. So there's maybe a little bit more space and thinking within Liz's piece, but with the same interesting physicality that Liz always brings to her work. Junior's amazing and a beautiful artist to be in the space with. He thinks really deeply and also gives us the space and time to explore the themes that he's looking into, which are can be quite dark, but also he allows us kind of to not go too deep into it that it takes away from what we're actually trying to say, which I think is really important. And Junior himself as a dancer is incredible. I always just want to watch him. He's amazing.
When I met Mufetor Yusuf, he was putting the Lúil dancers through their rehearsal paces for Invocation. Mufetor, or Junior, as he's called in the rehearsal, is Irish-Nigerian, and he looks to his African roots for inspiration for his piece, Invocation.
Fundamentally, Invocation means, I think for me, it's the process of invoking something, either from within or from another realm. Like if I think, like I'm Yoruba, I'm from the Yoruba tribe in Nigeria, and when I think invocation from my own kind of ancestral spiritual perspective, it's a process of communicating with your ancestors and with your God and your deities and so on, and invoking their energy and their power to help guide you through a process, through life, or through different episodes of experiences and so on. And then I suppose in the context of memory, which is one of the things that we're also working on, I suppose it's invoking, going to a place in which you invoke your shadow, and you can have those conversations with your shadows and understand what is your relationship with your own shadows and your own trauma or something like that. But I think within the context of this show, I try not to go too much into that space of like a really personal trauma. It's rather illustrate how movement and how the body can be part of that process of invoking those memories and dealing with them and processing them. But it's not like I'm putting the dancers through relieving their own trauma. It's more what the body can do. It's more to illustrate the potential and the capacity of the body to help through that process.
I wondered how invocation works with two other pieces under the title of Cora.
Good Cora, I mean, I think it's the whole premise of that is to create a space that is shared between three different voices, three different visions, and three different ideas, and just to see how we coexist in those spaces, I suppose, you know. I think that was somehow the foundation of this. And then regarding what we want to communicate and what we want to put individually out there, I think that was quite open, because to really honor the whole concept of a shared space, anything should go, and it's more about negotiating how they coexist. And I think that's up to, not only up to the makers, but also up to the audience to be able to watch how these three different pieces coexist in one evening on one platform.
Muftau, who established his name as a dancer and choreographer before becoming an associate artist of Lowell, is based in Belgium and Ireland. His 2023 piece, Impasse, was a two-performer work. I wonder what it was like for him working with seven members of the Lowell Company.
Yeah, which by itself comes with its own challenges, but in the beginning it was quite frightening. But then once I kind of allowed myself to ease into it, I understood that, okay, I can still have a sense of groundedness in my ideas, and then I can just see how that kind of comes through how I work with the other dancers and move them to the space and organize them to the space. I think generally the way I think, I don't think linearly, I don't talk linearly at times. I start in the middle, finish, go to the end and finish at the beginning. And I see that, I observe that in myself. And sometimes I can see that when I work with one person, there's a pace at which they receive those information. But when you're in a room full of eight dancers or seven dancers, it's different, and you perceive those differences, but you still try to make it work and make the best of it and drive forward, I suppose.
Muffeto talked about how he develops a piece from concept to a performance.
I generally imagine, like, I see the framework before I go into the space. I imagine what energy they might be moving with in the space, and I imagine a certain kind of, almost as if there's a drawing in the space to see how they move from one space to another. But in the actual content of the choreography, I don't generally have that. I prefer to work with the dancers for that. And in that way, it becomes a collaborative process in which I come with some sets of ideas, and then I give them prompts, and I say, okay, they just start to improvise around these things, and then something might start to take shape, and then we start to pin something down, and then we might start to go in a certain direction. But then that's the beauty of the artistic process, in which you come to places where you're like, oh, I'm not sure this is where I'm actually intending to go. Either you follow it or you deviate and you try a different direction. And that has been happening through this process, in which the place we're at now is quite different to what I'd initially prepared. But that's normal, and I know I always expect that to happen. But then I think too many times I have to also make changes. I'm just like, okay, no, I think I need to try this and try that, you know. And you start to negotiate with the material itself, as well as you're negotiating with the dancers, as well as you're negotiating with the design and everything. So everything is all I think maybe negotiating is the right word. Like, you just keep negotiating through the whole process until you arrive somewhere where you say, okay, this could be where I want to go, and then you offer it.
I think you should be able to hear the 1, 2, 3. And then once you hear the third one, that's the 1, 2, 3, 4. Is that clear? So we start from the third one to the... Can we try it full out?
Llewellyn is a permanent company offering dancers permanent contracts rather than project contracts. I asked Clara Kerr what it was like to be part of Llewellyn.
It's amazing. I mean, that's honestly as simple as it gets. I never thought this opportunity would arise on the island at all. You know, most dancers, my whole career here has been freelance. So the opportunity to be full-time is just amazing. And it's also given us the time to really find ourselves as a group, and the dancers are all amazing and they're all lovely, and it's just been a real opportunity to learn from each other, learn from these incredible choreographers coming in, and even simple things like having class every day is just not something that's possible here as a freelance dancer, so it's been such an incredible way to learn, to grow, and I'm so excited to see what come of the next few years.
And what are our hopes and dreams for the new company?
I want to say that it is sort of the new wave of Irish contemporary dance. I think we have so many beautiful artists here and makers, and Liz and Junior and people that are working with us in the future that are Irish as well have their own voices. And I think some of them are maybe influenced by Irish culture, some maybe not so much. And a mix of European and Irish kind of brings this new language or new wave. And I hope that Llewellyn is maybe the platform or the opportunity to elevate that Irish contemporary dance platform, that there's real big talent here, and it's so exciting to be the company that potentially puts that forward.
I was talking to dancer Clara Kerr, an artist in residence, Mafuto Yusuf of Llewellyn. That's Ireland's national dance company. And you heard original music composed by Sam Perkins and Julia Wolfe. Llewellyn, Ireland's national dance company, will share its inaugural performance, Cora, in collaboration with the Irish Chamber Orchestra, presented by Dublin Dance Festival at the Bord Gáis Energy Theatre on May the 13th. Then off on a national tour to the National Opera House in Wexford, Lyric Theatre in Belfast, Cork Opera House. You can get more information from Llewellyn.ie. And here on Arena in early May, we're going to host the launch of a new album by the great Irish band Kela, with special live show in Studio One in our beloved RTÉ Radio Centre. Formed in Dublin's Cláiste Óin in the late 1980s, Kela have always been innovators, and in this latest album, they're merging their traditional Irish music roots with an 8-piece brass band. So if you would like to join us in Studio One for the launch of the new album, Raise the Road from Kela and Brass, at 7 p.m. on Tuesday the 6th of May, send us an email to arena@rte with Kela in the subject line. That's it for tonight's show. Paula Shields was the researcher. Damien Chanels was on sound. Ollie Hamilton was the broadcast coordinator. And tonight's show was produced by Sinead Egan. John Creedon is next.